Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
In the quiet after sundown, we have reached each other's souls, both wondering of the other, how far can this one go? We have based our trust on friendship, that we know no bounds.
It's 8 o'clock, it's Thursday night, this is LA Talk Radio, and you're listening to Around the Barn. I'm Nancy Pitchford Z, and my co-host is over there is Bobby Jean Bell. No, this is actually The Writer's Block, and I'm Jim Christina, and across from me is Bobby Jean Bell, and of course her husband Jim is over there holding up the wall. What you were just listening to was music that I wrote, 30 years ago. We did a little EP in Tacoma in Port Orchard, Washington, at a little studio called Hark, and my band's name was Sundown, and we're going to be playing some intermittently during the night, so... great week. I just had just so much fun planning this little surprise for you. I told you at lunch you were going to have a surprise.
I know.
And that's why I asked you if you and Nancy were still talking. If you weren't still talking, I wasn't going to do it.
Oh, my goodness. Of course we're still talking. I'm excited to see what she's got going on.
Oh, yeah. It sounds like she's got some fun stuff.
She does.
Yeah.
She does.
So who do we have tonight, Bobby?
Well, we have in the studio Jerry Christina.
Oh.
And Jerry's waving at us.
For
those of you that, yes. And Jerry is taking on the reins of booking for this show, which we just are so grateful for all of the authors and others that have been asking to come on the show. Jerry's keeping that very organized for us. And, of course, she's the better half of the other guest that we have on tonight, who's the founder of The Writer's Block and author. You know who he is?
I do.
Jim Christina.
Yes. Yay.
And tonight he's also our engineer.
And I'm doing that too. And I'm reading some stuff.
Yeah.
And reciting some stuff. And
yeah.
Playing some music and just having fun.
So do you want to give a nod to our sponsors before we get started?
I would. The Writer's Block is brought to you by Black Dog Publishing of Simi Valley and by Out West Boutique and Cultural Center in Newhall, California. And everybody keep listening. And if you're just now joining us, we're going to have a lot of fun tonight. If you want to call in and talk to anybody in this room, that includes the bookie, the number is 818-602-4929. That's 818-602-4929.
Well, Mr. Christina,
yes,
we are so honored to have you here tonight with us at the Writer's Block.
Well, I'm here every week.
Radio show. I know, but tonight you're wearing multiple hats, as always.
I'm wearing a hat tonight.
But tonight you are, I know, you are wearing a hat tonight, I know. But tonight we're just really excited. I'm excited to have the opportunity for our listeners to really kind of get to know the man behind the voice. So I'm going to start by doing an introduction for you like we always do.
Okay.
All right, so here we go. Our guest tonight, Jim Christina, is certainly no stranger to the entertainment world. For years, he played with a popular acoustic vocal group in the Seattle-Tacoma area in Washington State. The band Sundown became a name in the field until Jim moved back to Southern California. And as he mentioned, we will be listening to a little bit of music from this group throughout tonight's show. Jim's fascination and passion for the history of the Old West led him to travel to the Southeast Arizona regularly. Tombstone and Bisbee are two of his favorite locations. Not able to contain the stories flowing in his imagination, he began writing a series of books in 2008 that has now snowballed into 11 novels with more on the way. The central character in many of these stories is The Hunter and his partner, Jeff Stryker. We'll be learning more about them this evening. Mostly set in the 1880s with titles like Requiem for an Appaloosa, Eastern Men, Long Ride to Morning, my favorite, The Dark Angel, Bugles in the Sun, Taggart, and his latest, Stillwaters, any lover of Western stories will appreciate the realism and grit these novels contain. Jim Christina's books are known for their compelling storylines, engaging characters, plot twists and turns, but what I like best about them is the window of the West he opens with his attention to detail and authenticity. If there is dialogue, firearms, horses, or the landscape in the text, you can bet he's drawing you an accurate picture. Since 2010, Jim has participated in all of Out West's many Rendezvous with a Writer author events, now the founder and host of the Writer's Block radio show and today's guest. We get to spend some time chatting with Jim, the author, and joining us is his wife, Jerry. Please welcome to the Writer's Block, Jim and Jerry Christina. Welcome.
Yay! We'd be here.
Time for a break?
Yeah, really. We're going to go to music now. And
oh, so Jim, that was really fun in the beginning. You had us all think that we were on a much-loved show called Around the Barn.
There you go.
Tell us a little bit about your experiences on Around
the Barn. Well, I was on Around the Barn, four times maybe?
Yeah.
And it was always a fun day. It was an hour of frivolity and fun. And first time I was on there, I think I shared it with Joyce Fitzpatrick. And then I was pretty much on by myself after that. It was great. Jerry joined us one day. But it was always a great experience.
Is that where you kind of got the thought about having your own radio show? Where did the writer's block kind of come from?
It came from my thought that there was a need in the writing community to be able to have a forum where they can come and they can talk. And writers love to talk about themselves, let's face it. So, I mean, that includes me. And, you know, radio makes everybody look good. So, but, I mean, yeah, back there, there's probably always been a little inkling that maybe one day I'd like to have my own show.
And, of course, you've got the perfect voice for radio.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know me in that I love to know a little bit about what inspires the creative process. So, tell us a little bit about what inspires you as a writer.
The story. I think the stories never go away. They're always around. The first 9 or 10 came as they rolled over each other as they went. And the last one was a desire to really bring back some people that I really liked, Cecilia Barnum and her daughters. Unfortunately, they were only around for 3.5 chapters, but hey, well, spoiler alert.
Well, not really a spoiler alert, because you actually say it on the back of the book. Like, I already knew, like, oh, they're not going to last much past the first 50 pages.
And then, as you know, I mean, you did the foreword for Dark Angel. Mm-hmm. And Jerry and I were talking one night, and I said, what do you think about this idea? And I was, you know, it was called Turnabout, where the hunter is now the hunted. And Jerry says, no, why don't you put him in Louisiana and bring back the Dark Angel? I said, capital idea.
So Jerry, who's
so I'm now 7 chapters into
the new project. All right, when we're going to talk more about that one in a minute. So Jerry, I would love to have you feel free to just jump in here, because I think you must be. Are you Jim's partly his sounding board?
Yes.
So does he share concept as he goes along, or are you reading what he's writing? How is it that you're able to support what he's doing?
Well, sometimes the night we will sit down and we'll chat about a chapter that he's written, or he'll call me on the phone, and I've gotten used to now him saying, are you sitting down? Because I thought there was like a real emergency. No, he's reading me his chapter, what he's writing. And, he says, well, what do you think? And I said, I think it's good, but you need to bring it home so I can read it. So, we go back and forth, and he discusses things with me. We bounces ideas, and I thought of the Louisiana thing because I just had to have the Dark Angel back again.
That was an
amazing book.
It was, and mm-hmm. he leaves it open. I mean, we kind of feel like there'll be more.
Yes.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Dark Angel kind of winds up in Reverend Cyrus Bills at the end of the book.
Exactly.
He picks on ministers or the holy men that have lost their faith.
Yeah, and the Dark Angel for our listeners who is, you don't really have to have read any of the books in the series. You can kind of pick up any book and get started.
Yeah.
But the Dark Angel definitely it can stand alone.
Oh, absolutely.
On its own, absolutely. Why do you set everything in the West? What is it about the West, Jim, that...
Roy Rogers. Lone Ranger, Hopalong Cassidy. I don't know. I was always transfixed in the West. It's just always been in my blood. I've always loved the idea of having horses and being able to go out in vast open spaces and just go.
And you're an equestrian. I mean, you're a very involved horse.
Well, yes, for years I was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now actually, don't have any horses anymore. Now I have a motorcycle, and that's a whole different story.
That's what Jerry just said to me.
I already spilled the beans.
Yeah. Oh. She's like, did he tell you about the motorcycle? I'm like, no.
Well, that was a long story in and of itself.
Another show.
Yeah. It's a whole different show, especially in cast.
Where would you say your writing career began?
When I was in junior high. I wrote short story after short story after short story, and 90% of them were Westerns.
Okay.
But as I got older and as I started onto the hunter phase, I wanted to make them real, because the Westerns never really were real. The men weren't real. The things they did weren't real. And I wanted to make sure that people understood that when you turned 50, your life wasn't over with. Mm-hmm. Here's a manhunter that's 58 years old when we first meet him, and he's still riding and chasing guys.
Right.
So.
Well, and some of the, and I said a little in the introduction, some of what you write, and I know that historically you can kind of take some poetic license, but when it comes down to gear and tack, mm-hmm. and proper ways of handling firearms, mm-hmm. and current inventions of the time, mm-hmm. and all that, you really nail that.
Well, it takes research.
Right. So tell us a little bit about the research.
Well,
process.
I mean, in The Hunter, there's a scene where he goes into a bar, and there is a milkshake machine at the end of the bar, and it's a hand crank milkshake machine. And they used to make like rum shakes in it, and they would make these milkshakes with vanilla, and then they pour rum in them, and you'd have a rum milkshake.
That was in Long Ride to Morning, I think.
Long Ride to Morning.
I remember that, and going, what? And that same book, before he enters the bar, he takes the
bridles off the horses.
Yeah, and I had never seen that in a movie. I'd never read that in any other books where, you know, you'd ride up. And you just see him, you know, hitching and walking through the double doors.
Right. Well, you never tied your horse with his reins.
Yeah.
Because if something happened, the horse pulled back. Not only would the reins break, but probably the hitching post would break and it would cut the hell out of their mouth.
Oh, okay.
So he just didn't do that.
Yeah.
That's why all the horses kept their halters on.
Now, I noticed I was reading Stillwaters, which is the most recent book.
Right.
And then I got into Taggart the other night, which was the book like before Stillwaters. Mm-hmm. And I was reminded that the good guys always take care of their horses before they bed down. They curry them, you know, they groom them, they make sure they're fed and grain and water. They carry water bladders with them. I mean, it's all about, and our bad guys never have quite enough to eat. They just barely, you know, get into camp. The horses, you know, well, they hobble them, but, you know,
a lot of times
they don't get nearly the attention.
You're not in the bad guys' camp long enough to see whether they're taking care of their animals or not, but chances are they're probably not. Hey, Lenny and Whitey never did, you know.
Yeah, Lenny.
So, I mean, but those guys are buffoons.
Yeah, so that kind of leads me into a little bit about characters.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to throw you some names.
Okay.
You are our engineer. So,
right.
You know, when we need to, you need to let me know. So you put on the engineer
I'll give you the signal.
Okay. So, of course, the first most important guy, you know, who is the hunter? And what is his job? What
okay,
does he do?
The hunter's name, actual name, is Taggart Richmond. Hence the latter book called Taggart. Taggart Richmond is known as a hunter because Jolly Goodman, his friend, named him that. And in fact, the conversation went kind of like, what do you do anyway? And Richmond answers back, well, the sheriff told me that I was a manhunter, so I guess that's what I do. And Jolly says, Taggart, what kind of handle is that? He goes, well, it was my father's, blah, blah, blah. He goes, not anymore. I'm just going to call you the hunter.
The hunter. And he's a young man. He's
in his 20s.
Getting started,
yeah, he's
really.
22, 23 at that point. Yeah.
And he's not a bounty hunter.
No, he's a manhunter. He won't hunt bounty. He did that one time.
Yeah. So who are these men that he's hunting?
He'll go after people that are wanted by ranchers for theft. He'll go after rustlers. He'll go after people that just disappear. Mm-hmm. The first story we see him, he's looking for a guy named Thomas Hardy that disappeared on a train in Contention, mm-hmm. Arizona, and his wife sends him to go find him.
Okay, so now another major character is, of course, Jeff Stryker.
Jeff Stryker.
And where and how do they meet?
Jeff Stryker and his good friend Bobby Malloy came from Texas. They're chasing a guy named Ty Frederick that killed their old friend, Mose Porter. And they follow Ty Frederick all the way through Texas into New Mexico, and finally they lose him in Arizona. And they wind up doing a cattle drive with the Pickerings to deliver some beeves to Fort Huachuca and to Fort Boy. Well, the Pickerings are killed. Nate Pickering is killed by the two bad guys. And his wife, I forgot her name now. Anyway, Mrs. Pickering is killed by Apaches. There was an Apache raid on the camp. So they're kind of left on their own devices to get these cattle delivered. And Stryker and Malloy, they have this thing about right, being righteous and right. Mm-hmm. And they make sure that the cattle are delivered. And then they send all the money to the Pickering's daughter. And the conversation at that point goes, "We got no money, Bobby. I got maybe $2 paper," and Bobby says, "I got maybe 75 cents in coin."
Yeah.
So they take off, and Hunter finds them in a bar in Douglas, Arizona.
In Douglas, Arizona. Right. And then you mentioned a couple you already mentioned Thomas Hardy. Okay, now Jolly Goodman. He's a little like Falstaff, except he's really not jolly. He kind of is named Jolly because he's sort of the opposite
of
jolly. And yet he really brings a breath of sort of jolliness.
He's a horrible drunk. He's profane. He's fat. He's short. He's old. He's acerbic as you can
but
be.
But you love him.
Oh, absolutely. Jolly was just a great character because he was fun to write.
And Jerry's nodding over here like, yeah, Jolly's really
Jolly was a good guy. Jolly required a rock to get on. He had to rock break his horse so he could mount.
Yes.
And he told the hunter one day, he says, "If I ever fall off this horse, just shoot me because I'm not going to be able to get back on unless there's a rock around." And he's just a guy. He's been the hunter's friend for 100 years. And
right. But you write him out. At some point,
I killed him off.
Well, I don't want to say that because because you do prequels and you do different things, and suddenly it's like, oh, Jolly's back, even though Jolly's not, you know. But
well, Jolly got in the way of the ghost.
Yes, the ghost.
And
yes.
The ghost is it. Jolly happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time and had to go potty at the wrong time of the
yeah.
day. And he got his throat slit.
All right. So before we get into more of sort of the bad guys, who is Arkansas Frank
Mallon?
Mallon. Yeah. Who's he?
Arkansas Frank Mallon is the man who taught the hunter his craft. And that was back in like 1845, 45. I think. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's really what sets Taggart out to be a manhunter.
Right. He goes up to Arkansas and he wants him to teach him, and he goes, "Why?"
Yeah.
So he pulls the old, "Well, okay, I'll give you 15 minutes. Meet me back here."
That was very clever.
And so Richmond runs to gets his stuff, and he meets him back at the barn, and he's gone.
Yep.
So the guy, he sits on the steps of the store, and the storekeeper come out, and he goes, "You know where he went?" He goes, "Yeah." He said, "If you can catch him,
you'll be an
apprentice. Teach you.
He'll teach you."
So,
and he learns about hoof hoots, you know.
He learned about all that stuff.
Now, a very interesting fellow shows up in Eastern Men. Eastern Men is just a romp. It's really funny, actually.
There's
comedic.
Places in it that are
pretty funny. Phineas Bellflower. I love the names you come up with. Like, Jerry, how did he come up with Phineas Bellflower?
They come out of nowhere. I don't know. It's just he grabs them out of the air.
It's the luck of the draw.
So who's this fellow, Phineas Bellflower?
Phineas Bellflower is a writer that came from Brooklyn. He wrote an expose on Big Mike McManus, who was the Fifth Ward boss of the Fifth Ward in Brooklyn. Real guy.
Okay.
Corrupt.
Uh-huh.
And Phineas wrote an expose on him. He got paid a lot of money. and Big Mike sent his hoodlums after him, and Phineas split town. He wound up in Chicago, and then from Chicago, he decided to go to Arizona and see what was going on down there.
Yeah, and we're back in Arizona, your favorite right. home state, and we're back probably around 18. A lot of what you write is sort of taking somewhere place there. In the 1880s, yeah. Who's the Apache Kid?
The Apache Kid was, I can't even pronounce his name. It's like okay. really long.
We'll go with Apache Kid.
Yeah, the Apache Kid actually was a real guy. He was a scout for the Army. He was a renegade.
And he was a real guy.
He was a real guy, yeah. Yeah, he scouted for the 6th Cavalry with Al Sieber for a long time, and then he went renegade. And they were chasing him all over the place.
But he befriends...
He becomes friends with the Hunter Jeff Stryker.
And he sort of shows up. He's in Stillwaters.
He kind of shows up when he wants to show up and doesn't when he doesn't want to.
And how do you know, this is a time for me to bring in Apache Kid?
Because his wife told him. So.
That's how. Honest answer.
Well, do you know, because he is as elusive as he is, he needs to show up when he shows up.
Yeah.
It's like a conversation going on, and all of a sudden this third voice comes in.
Right. So do you keep a list, like, off to the side somewhere of all the characters in all the books that you review and go, oh, yeah, I really liked writing about so-and-so. This is it. No,
Just the ones I'm currently writing.
Okay. And what about Bountiful Jim Lent and Louis Bishop?
My favorite character.
Bountiful Jim Lent is, he is a cowboy that... the whole Bar A crowd met in the saloon in Tombstone. And they first met him because he stepped to the bar and these two guys started calling him the N-word because he is big black cowboy.
And it's after Civil War.
Right. It's after the Civil War. And it's in the 1880s. And and he never was a slave and his family never were slaves. So he didn't get this whole race thing.
Right.
And the guy started mouthing off to him and he threw one guy out and he punched the other guy and he went flying out the door and... Then they called him over, and they liked the guy. They just liked the guy. So they were going to buy him a beer because he smashed his beer over this one guy's head. And the guy he threw out comes back in with a big steel bar in his hand, and Jim turns around and just hauls off and whales him another one. Right back out the door he goes. And
yeah, these are page turn. If you're listening to the description of the action, as much as these are fabulous characters and great dialogue, they are full of action. These are page turners.
They are.
And we're talking about, in this case, the book Contraband Cowboys.
Contraband Cowboys.
And Jim, tell me a little bit about that title and how you titled this book, where that came from.
The title Contraband Cowboys comes from the term contraband that the slaves were called when they would run away. And they were known as contraband because they belonged to a slave owner. And that term stuck, and it stuck to almost every black that came out of the South. And, in fact, after the Civil War, they had this big, huge contraband camp in Virginia. And a lot of these guys went there to live, and then a lot of them never left the plantations. Right. A lot of them moved west and became cowboys because they had knowledge of cattle, they had knowledge of horses. And they were extremely respected. They were well paid, well taken care of. They never had very many problems at all with any of the ranchers or ranch hands or anything. I mean, they were very respected.
Because they could do the work.
They could do the work.
It was all
about,
could you do
the work? Kept their
mouth
shut, mm-hmm. and they just did their work.
Right. And about 25%, I think, kind of, historians really continuing to study the West now say at least 25% of the working cowboy after the Civil War is African-American.
Is African. Actually, the figure I got was 40%.
Okay. Well, of course, more and more research and coming across family stories and histories and things continues to evolve.
But Louis Bishop is his half-brother.
Right.
And he has a ranch up in Williamson County in Arizona by Prescott. And he's been raided by Knight Riders.
Yes, the Knight Riders.
Which were an import from the Carolinas and Georgia. And they were the precursor of the Ku Klux Klan in the South.
They're bad guys.
And they're bad guys.
Clearly bad guys.
They're clearly bad guys.
Yeah, and we meet them in the early pages of
We do.
Book.
We meet them actually in the prologue.
Yeah, they're bad guys.
Yeah, they're real bad guys.
Yeah, no two ways about it. And then another wonderful character, John Connolly.
John Connolly is a corporal in I Company in the 7th Cavalry. And that whole book, Bugles in the Sun, was written exactly as it happened. That's the way the book was written. So if they say they go there at a certain day, that's where they went. And Connolly is the only fictitious character in the entire book. Everyone else mentioned in that book is real.
And this book, of course, Bugles in the Sun, is such an apropos title because I think you had read a reference to Bugles in the Sun.
Charles Varnum was the chief of scouts in the 7th Cavalry, and he had made a report that when they first came down from Reno Hill and they were walking the battlefield, he kept seeing glints of things, and as he approached one, he found it was a bugle.
Right.
Hence the title, Bugles in the Sun.
Right. And it follows, is it the last 20 days before
20 days,
the battle?
Right,
the,
leading up to
the Battle of the Little Bighorn.
Right.
Right. And it's really, is it the only book, Jim, at the moment that doesn't involve Stryker? All the other books.
These are the only ones that has nothing to do with the hunter.
Right, right. So what kind of called you out to do that book?
I always wanted to do that. I always wanted to write a book that each chapter started with a diary or entry or journal entry.
Mm-hmm, that's right. That is different about this book
right. Also.
Yeah. Okay, so now I'm going to – do we need to do a break?
We can do a little music here.
All right, we'll take a little break. We're talking with Jim Christina on the Writer's Block.
And as we go in, we'll just give you a little something that is right that I wrote in 1980.
Doing something that is right don't make it easy when it's done.
To turn around. And we're back, and that is a song that I wrote in 1980. It's called Something That Is Right. The voice you hear in there is a gentleman named David Oddie, who was our lead singer, and actually the songs that I wrote for the band at the time were written for his voice because he had such a great voice.
Beautiful
for that
voice.
Type of music.
Beautiful voice.
Yeah, it really was. And to this day, I would do music with David again if he was hanging around anywhere.
If you have any questions for Jim or wife Jerry, who also schedules the show, please do feel free to give us a call at 818-602-4929. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe you'd like to ask Jim something about writing, or you'd want to ask Jerry if there are any open dates left for this calendar year.
Which would be a no.
Would be a big no.
But you're always welcome to call in and tell us maybe about a new book that you're working on or something that you have going on. We'd love to hear from you. Now I want to ask you a little bit about the bad guys.
Okay.
I think you like writing bad guys.
I love writing bad guys. You can have so much fun with bad guys. Let me give you an example. I'm going to do a little reading from the Dark Angel.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Yay!
Because I think this personifies who the Dark Angel was.
Oh, so nasty.
He has gone back to his lair. He is now very, very, very pissed off because Stryker and the Hunter have once again averted him, and he's getting very angry. So the deacon knew he had to cleanse himself, offer the Dark Angel his due. Lately it had become more and more often he found himself in his lair, stripped to the waist and bleeding from the self-flogging he administered for the Dark Angel. Lately it seemed the beatings he was given were driving him further and further from reality, further from the sanity he had once prided himself to possess in his congregation. He had once been the deacon of the Southern Baptist Church of Dothan, Alabama, the man everyone stood to respect and admire. His life was full and going where it had been intended. Not this monster that now inhabited his soul, his psyche, and his being. This dark angel that had taken him over during a vulnerable period, a period in which he had renounced God. The period just following the death of Idbelay, and he succumbed. He gave his life to whatever force was invading him. He gave his reason and his sensibilities over to a force he could neither see nor understand. That's the Dark Angel.
I don't know, Jerry. Do we really want him back?
Yes, we do.
I have to tell you that he's now in Alabama, or Louisiana, and he's now calling himself the preacher. And his powers are like six times.
Yes, okay.
What they were.
And this is the next book that you're working on.
It's called The Return.
The Return. Oh, that's
it's quite
powerful.
The challenge.
And you've had to do some research even on Cajun.
And I forgot to bring a sheet. I have an entire speech by this Cajun guy. It took me 2 days to write it because Cajun is so hard to speak.
Right.
And there's a lot of French, English, Cajun words that, you know, you got the Cajun dictionary up there and you're doing research on the Cajun and you're, oh my God, it is just horrible.
Well, and that is one of the things about the dialogue in all of your books. I do feel like it's not antiquated. I'm in the time period, and yet it's totally readable. It doesn't feel like I'm reading a ancient sort of text,
right?
You know?
Well, it's syncopated. It's got a rhythm to it.
Yeah, I think actually your books are really great for reading aloud. So I would encourage you, get one of Jim's books and read it aloud. read it aloud.
There's with a glass of wine.
Yeah, the language is really wonderful. Okay,
salty.
Well, in the beginning, yes, that was something I said to you. It's salty, but that it's not salty anymore. It's exactly what it should be. Though some of it you couldn't probably read aloud on the radio. Well, this station maybe.
This station we can do it. But I've actually chosen passages that don't have any salty language in them, so.
Excuse me. Okay, you have a couple other kind of bad guys. Tell us a little bit about Ghost.
The Ghost. His name was Nathan. I forget what his name was.
Well, he has another sort of nickname.
Yeah.
No,
El Fantasma.
Yes.
Yeah, that was his Spanish. That's what the Mexicans called him,
yes,
the Ghost.
Yes.
But he was a black Irishman from Missouri, and he'd killed his parents and his sisters. And it just took off.
And he's called Ghost because he has an unusual thing about his skin.
Yes, it's actually pure white.
Yes.
His hair is dark, dark, dark black, and his eyes are piercing blue. And he just disappears.
He just disappears.
Yeah. And he kills with a knife.
Yes, yes. And, you know, that sort of segues into, as much as I also want to talk about, I can't believe how fast our time is going, but weapons are also characters in a lot of your books. Stryker's got a couple of very powerful firearms. This guy, Ghost, you know, he's got that Bowie. It's a Bowie knife, right?
Yeah, it's a big Bowie knife.
Bowie knife. You really make the landscape is characters. You know, where Deacon has his lair is really... like
that's a real place, actually.
It's a real place.
Yeah, it's a real place.
And some of these places show up kind of again and again, where, you know, the Circle J Ranch and the Bar A, and they all feel like you've endowed these places and gear and firearms and everything kind of with a life of their own.
Well, you try to bring the Circle J Ranch, of course, was Jolly's. They got that from the other family that the hunter hired to take care of the Bar A Ranch. And excuse me. And so the Circle J has evolved into a pretty nice operation now, with Jolly being dead, and they decided, the hands all decided, because this young kid named Bill Drewer took over the responsibility of building and taking care of the ranch, and he's done just a wonderful job. And he cleaned up the little graveyard and where Jolly is buried,
right.
and the people that took over the Hunter's Ranch, Charlie and...
That's not the Pickerings.
No.
No, it's not the Barnetts.
Oh.
No.
I don't
know.
Anyway, they took care of Horse when Horse was hurt.
Yep. See, he needs to have that list of you.
I know.
To the side.
At home, you probably could have gone just
I know.
Like
at home, I could have done it that quick.
Now, you've got Big Ed Burns and James Addison Rivas.
Both real people.
Oh, are they real people?
And Big Ed Burns was a con man, and he actually... tried that land grab down in Arizona and didn't make it, was pushed out of the territory, wound up in Denver, and then went with Soapy Smith up to Skagway.
Oh, with Soapy Smith?
Right.
Oh, my goodness.
So he's a real guy.
He's a real guy.
James Addison Rivas, also a real man. He was known as the Baron of Arizona. Primarily hijacked the Peralta land grant.
So if that title is of interest to you, that's Rights of Men. They're the featured kind of bad guys in Rights of Men. Now, we have a really valiant Apache warrior in Still Waters.
Well, he's not too valiant.
Well, he's got his own code.
He does.
He's living with his code, and he starts out with 30 warriors that come off the reservation, and they've got their own code that they're living by. Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, he's a medicine man and a war chief for the Chiricahua Apache. His name is Goyacte.
Yeah, I needed you to say it. Yeah. I can read it, but
and he's got 30 warriors that jump San Carlos, and they are raiding throughout Arizona.
Yes,
and that's what starts this whole book, Still Waters.
Yes. And it's a fight to the finish.
It is a fight to the finish. Actually, and, they whittled them down one by one. Yeah. And it's amazing how they do it.
And I think, again, Jim, do you have a sense as you're getting started on a story, you know, like, did you already know how that fight? Because sometimes, you know, you do take people out of a story that we're sad to see go.
Mm-hmm.
So I really didn't know till the end, really. Who was
going to
prevail?
Win.
Because you as a writer trick us oftentimes.
A couple times.
Yeah. So I won't spoiler alert this, but did you know, or did you just let that write itself? And
well, I knew the hunter wasn't going to die.
Okay, so okay, you didn't know that.
But I didn't know Goyacte was going to die either.
Oh, because he could have probably
he could have lived
and come back. For,
he could have lived, but circumstances as they were, when the final scene comes down.
Uh-huh.
It had to be that way from that one thing that the hunter saw.
Right.
That one piece of metal that the hunter saw.
Right, right.
And that did him. That did him in right there.
Yeah.
Now, if you would allow me,
sure.
Another passage from
absolutely
from Still Waters.
He's got a great reading voice, Jerry, doesn't he?
He does, but I have to say a little something about him. If I don't get a chapter, if he's writing a book and I don't get a chapter for 3 weeks, I think something's wrong.
Ah.
So I immediately either call him, or when he comes home, I say, are you done? Is this it? No. I'll do it. So
Still Waters kind of run with him too, huh?
Yeah.
Well, not too deeply though.
Not very often, but
okay. This is a passage where the hunter and Stryker are watching the Apaches try to get to them, and they're actually dragging burning wood and greasewood behind their ponies, trying to create a diversion. And this is how this goes. Stryker was the first on his horse, riding again Bandit. It was now Stryker did something the hunter did not expect. Stryker spurred Bandit and took off in the direction of the attacking Apaches. Galloping full speed, Stryker pulled the Winchester carbine from its boot and held it over his head, yelling like a banshee, seeming to have lost all control of his senses. Halfway to the smoke cloud, Stryker could plainly see the warriors coming on at a gallop, dragging burning mesquite and greasewood branches behind them, smoking and flaming as they came. Then he was in them, swinging the Winchester like a club. Catching the first Apache soundly on the skull, the warrior dropped from his horse, bouncing before he lay still. Stryker continued his headlong rush through the advancing warriors until he was all the way through, suddenly yanking Bandit to a stop. Spinning the little horse, he again charged through the Apaches, catching another on the back with the Winchester. He flipped the carbine and jacked the cartridge into the chamber, firing at the closest Apache to him. The gunfire caught everyone by surprise, and the warrior grabbed his chest, reeling to his right, trying to correct himself, tumbled to the left side of his horse and onto the hard-packed dirt. Stryker galloped alongside another warrior and again swung in the Winchester, hitting the warrior in the shoulder blades and snapping the stock of the carbine. Throwing the carbine aside, Stryker pulled his pistol, fired two quick shots into the grouped warriors, not hitting anyone during his dash back to through the Apaches. So that's the action.
Yeah, Stryker, you know, I held my breath through all of that. Like, amazing. No fear. These men have absolutely no fear.
Well, he's never had any fear.
No, they've never had any fear.
Stryker is, Stryker's got gonads the size of St. Louis. He's young yet. He's only like 22, 23.
Yeah,
he doesn't have any fear.
No fear. And total respect for the hunter. You know, still calls him the hunter.
Hunter.
Mr. Hunters, thank you. Yes, Mr. Hunter. Well, you mentioned in that passage, of course, he's riding a horse. And horses are very important characters in your books. Horse being one of them.
Horse was
Tell us about horse.
Horse was the hunter's son's horse.
Yes.
He had bought him. Horse for his son Henry, and Henry, being 10 years old and not listening to his father, took the horse out someplace he wasn't supposed to and got snake bit.
Yeah,
and didn't say a word. Came back into the house and went to bed. And later that night, it was discovered that he had been bitten twice by a rattlesnake, and he died in his father's arms.
And horse
was in the barn when the hunter went to go saddle his horse, and he saw horse and horse nickered at him, so he just took him instead, and that's the only horse he rode there for 16 years.
Right. And horse is based on a dear horse of yours.
Yes, he was. After String of Roses, my Roseman, big Appaloosa boy, yeah. And horses in Appaloosa.
Jim has a wonderful website. It's just jimchristina.net. And there are great descriptions of each of these books and also wonderful photos. And you've got some great pictures mm-hmm. of Roseman on your website.
Yeah, I have Roseman and Bandit.
And you have a lot of photos that are sort of done in sepia mm-hmm. or black and white. Mm-hmm. And those, tell where were all those?
There was some taken at Corriganville in Simi Valley.
Oh, that's
actually by Jerry.
Corriganville, okay.
Who is quite the photographer
yeah,
in her own right.
Yeah.
She did a lot of the cover art for
right,
the books, too.
Right.
And there was some of that were taken with my camera phone, and there were some that were taken. I mean, you know, every photo goes into Photoshop.
Oh,
so.
Yes, yes. Now, there's a few other horses that make appearances.
Mm-hmm.
Bandit?
Bandit actually was my horse as well.
Oh, okay. And who rides Bandit?
Bandit is the hunter's new horse.
Okay. And then there's Chance.
Chance was the horse that replaced Waco.
Right, Waco. I knew there was a horse I had.
Waco was Stryker's horse. He was a Comanche war pony.
Right.
And he was killed.
Right.
And everybody said, oh, you killed off Waco.
Yeah.
God. He was such a cool horse.
And Cochise is a horse?
Cochise was an Appaloosa that Thomas Hardy bought for the hunter.
Right, okay. Yeah, so it's really cool to have these, you know, horses are very much characters in these
absolutely
books
are.
As well. Now, the women, I can't believe we're already at... You know, we're coming down.
Got about
here
7 minutes left.
Yeah. Now, Jerry, how do you feel about the way he writes about women? You have any sense of these women, Juliet and Cecilia and Ella and Maggie?
Yeah, I liked Juliet.
Yeah. Oh, I was not happy with you.
Nobody was happy with that. I got nasty phone calls from my sister over some of these characters.
Juliet is a character in Dark Angel, and when Jim asked me to write the foreword to it, of course I couldn't, you know, I couldn't write the foreword without reading the book, and oh, I was not happy with what Juliet's fate was.
Yeah, she actually had fallen victim to the ghost at one point.
What was the music you were talking about?
Carmina Burana.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he played that for me. And I told him and I told you that if I read that book, I couldn't listen to that music at the same time. and you can't be in a candlelit room and read the book either.
Yeah,
you
no. Yeah, that was the music that came to my mind at the time. So, and tell us a little bit about Cecilia Barnum.
Cecilia Barnum is some woman and her daughters, and actually her husband William, that the hunter stayed at their ranch when he was injured while Stryker was looking for the ghost. And she and the hunter became quite close and good friends. And I thought at the time as I was writing that there was something a little going on between them as far as emotionality goes. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to explore that a little more. So when I started on Still Waters, I wanted to bring Cecilia back because I really liked her.
Yeah, he brought her back and then took her, snuffed her out.
I know.
Well, Goyacte snuffed her out. I just wrote
no,
it.
No, you're the right, yeah.
But it's, you know, I liked her as a woman. There's not many women in my books at all, so.
Okay, so I'm looking at our time and I'm realizing we have not yet asked you the most important question.
Yes, I do.
Fill in the blank. How do you handle writer's block?
Well, I think we've discussed this when Janet was here. I don't go back and rename characters because it takes me a long time to name a character, and I don't really think that it's necessary to rename a character. I may go back and rewrite something or maybe fix a turn that I made that I shouldn't have made. Or I would just go think of another scene I want to write, and I'll go write that and stick it aside until it comes time to put it in. And then all of a sudden, it's gone, and I just keep going.
Right. And are you working on more than one project at a time?
I actually am right now.
You are right now.
Yeah.
But typically, has it sort of been all-consuming with one project?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wasn't giving myself much time in between them, so I was...
You must have to do a lot of research,
because yeah,
again, all of the detail...
It's pretty hard.
In the researching process, is there anything that is really, you know, like we like to ask that question, something that surprised you, something unexpected that you, you know, that you discovered? Not really?
No.
When you're researching, do you get an idea for another book?
Always.
That, you know, you kind of have to file that away?
Always.
Yeah. And Do you know the character's fate in advance?
Yeah.
You do. You just don't know how it's going to...
I don't know how it's going to play out.
Right.
I always know the start of the story, and I know how the end story is going to end. And I sometimes I just let the characters drive the story.
Right. Now, we've had Stryker and the Hunter in many of these books, obviously, and I do see character development, which it'd be easy not to. I mean, it'd be easy to just kind of write mm-hmm. them the same all the time. How would you say Jeff Stryker has changed from the beginning to where he is now?
He's totally grown as a man. He is. I mean, he's got taken all the responsibility. Mm-hmm. He is. I mean, from the student, from the young student, now he has grown into the one who actually will take the lead. Knows what he's doing. He's grown like 2 inches and put on like 20 pounds. And, you know, he was just a skinny, scraggly kid.
Exactly.
And now he's grown into a man. In fact, they at the bar, at the Circle J, they make mention that, wow, they don't even look like Stryker.
Right, right.
You know, he let his hair grow out. He's got the range cut now. And he, you know, wears the same clothes as the Hunter wears. And, you know, he looks like.
They're a remarkable partners.
They are.
They really are.
There's a lot of respect between the two of them.
A lot of respect, yes. So we don't have a lot of time left, Jim. I know we also like to ask that question about self-publishing versus working with a publisher. And you've done self-publishing.
Yeah, I do. I go through the Amazon, but I also go through Black Dog Publishing,
yes,
too.
Yes, yes. So. And can you tell us a little bit about Black Dog Publishing?
Well, we're new. I mean, you know, we're just getting off the road and just primarily right at the moment just publishing my own stuff. I've got some people that want me to consult for them, which is fine. I can do that.
Right.
Because a lot of guys don't even know how to get started.
Yeah.
You know, and I'd rather just sit down and talk to them.
And Jerry's the editor for Black
Jerry's Dog Publishing. Actually quite a good editor, and she's we call her the comma queen.
Yeah, he's the and I'm the comma.
Yeah, and that's pretty much the way our whole relationship goes. I'm the and she's the comma.
And I'm the dot, dot,
and
dot.
And also, she's our bookie.
And yeah, she's our bookie, and we've got some great shows coming up. I have the list in front of me, Jerry. Do you have the list in front? I don't want to put you on a hot spot if you're not, you know, knowing, like, who's coming up next week and such.
I have John Bergstrom next week.
Yes. Our good friend, singer-songwriter. And performer will be here in the studio. And then on July 23rd.
We have Ed Erdelak.
Oh, and I won't be here that night. And we love Ed.
Ed is such a fun guy.
Very fun. And then on the 30th, we have our first blogger that
we
be
do.
Henry Park. I looked at his blog today, and it was amazing.
Yes. And we really, Henry, if you're listening tonight, we really appreciate your coverage of the Writer's Block radio show on your recent blog. And he's just all mm-hmm. over the place covering what's happening in
right.
Western
right.
film and TV. And he's writing now for True West Magazine. True West Magazine.
Right.
And then next week we'll go into what's happening in August. But Jerry, we really thank you for taking the reins on keeping us organized.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, we are totally booked. We are not going to be broadcasting on Thanksgiving, Christmas Eve, or New Year's Eve.
Right.
We'll be doing rerun shows.
Right.
But other than that, tonight's been fun.
Well, tonight's been fun, and I have a final kind of comment that I thought tied this show up, and it's actually from the book Lord Jim, written by Joseph Conrad. My task, which I am trying to achieve, is by the power of the written word to make you hear, to make you feel. It is, before all, to make you see.
Wow.
Nice.
And that's it.
Incidentally, I have to tell you that the return also starts with a Bible scripture.
And you've got J.R. Sanders writing the foreword to that one, right?
J.R. Sanders is going to be writing the foreword to that one.
And Jerry's needs water or something.
No, we just need to shout out to Lisa at Wood Ranch.
Oh, yes, and I need to
shout out to our friend Lisa at Wood Ranch. And Lisa, I hope you're listening. And if you are, hi. And if not, I'm sorry we missed you.
We'll see you on Sunday.
And I'm gonna say one more thing before I go. This is a stanza from a poem I wrote 100 years ago. And it's very long, but you're only going to get the first stanza. And it's called The Ball. Await, my love, nay, come to hide. Doff through the burrow, be by my side. The trail of love is soft, yet nil to sit upon my castle wall. That's all I'm going to say. Thank you all for listening. Thanks, Bobby Jean, for the great show. Thanks, Bookie, for being here. Jim? Always a pleasure.
Or the Bucker.
We are out of here. Have a great week, and thanks for listening.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.